I'm Michael O'Connell. Welcome to It's All Journalism. No matter how you look at it, we live in a highly polarized society. At the beginning of April, the Chronicle of Philanthropy launched a vertical called The Commons to focus on the issue of polarization, along the lines of political ideology, gender, income, race, geography, culture, and religion. Today, I'm talking to Drew Lindsay, a senior writer at The Chronicle, who is leading The Commons initiative. Drew, welcome to It's All Journalism.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for your time.
Okay. So before we dig deep into the Commons, you know, tell me a little about yourself. What got you interested in being a journalist? How'd you end up at The Chronicle?
Sure. Well, I have to say, Mike, I'm a Watergate baby and that I grew up.
You and me both.
Yeah. We had that experience. So when I was in grade school, the Watergate hearings were going on and my mom watched every day and I'd sort of sit at her feet and play with her spools of thread while she was watching. I became sort of enamored with Woodward and Bernstein and read All the President's Men in the Final Days when I was really young. So that sort of got me into the bug to do journalism. After college, I got the magazine bug. I was asked to stay at the college and produce the alumni magazine, which was a really exciting and fun thing for a young person to do. So been doing magazines for almost 35 years now. Came to the Chronicle in 2014. It had been a weekly newspaper, very much straight up news, covering the events of the week and such, a weekly newspaper. I was brought on to help it transition to a monthly magazine. So that was about 10 years ago, and now moving on to the Commons.
Okay. So, you know, for those who are not familiar with the Chronicle of Philanthropy, could you sort of fill us in on a few of the details, what the publication is?
Sure. We're an independent nonprofit news outlet, and we're covering really what's an undercovered area of the country, in a sense, the world of nonprofits and philanthropy. So that's everything from the Bill Gates Foundation to the local soup kitchen. We're covering everything from the biggest donors, the people who are given hundreds of millions of dollars, to everyday donors and what nonprofits do at the local level. What's sort of interesting about this, I think, is that this is a field that's really undercovered, that the mainstream press, for years, they'll have a charity reporter who might go to some charity events, or they'll have a, you know, in December, they'll have a charity drive of some sort. But there are very few mainstream outlets that cover this, despite the fact, I mean, the field, one of every 11 workers in the country works at a nonprofit. It is a trillion-dollar industry that has enormous influence, not only on our politics, but on everyday life. And it's just so undercovered that we feel like we have this really important space to be doing our work. We're covering it as you might expect, say, American lawyer or American banker to cover their industries. We're writing for the people in the field. But we really feel like this has, for lack of a better word, societal impact in what we're doing.
As a local reporter, you know, I can't tell you how many times I go to cover an event, and it's something that's put on by a charity, and also, you know, our local government relies on the nonprofit community to provide a lot of services. Rather than stand up in office to address homelessness, they'll reach out to some, you know, charity that is helping homeless people and support them to do that work. So it's ingrained in all parts of our lives. So the Commons seems like something really kind of very different than that. How did that, you know, sort of come up as this is something we think would be a good vertical for us to work on?
Sure. And I think it's for this audience particularly to talk about the genesis of it out of our DNA in the sense of, as I said, we have been a traditional newspaper news outlet for a lot of years. We do a lot of straight-up news coverage. We do some service work for people in the field, sort of how do you do your job better. We also have an opinion section, which is two or three opinion pieces a week, and that will vary little from what you might see on the opinion page of the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that kind of thing. And we really feel like, in a sense, that the internet and journalism in general has shifted in terms of how it views opinion. So we were looking, my editor-in-chief, now the CEO of the nonprofit, Stacey Palmer, even a year and a half ago was sort of conjuring the idea of a commons as a way to expand the work we do in the opinion space, to do ideas journalism, to do roundtables, to do Q&As, to do a whole range of things that sort of open up the idea of what you mean when you do opinion. So we've been nurturing that idea in the background, and I think we came to the idea of polarism and the country's divides in a sense as we headed into 2024. obviously, all of our divides are going to be on grand display at this point during the elections. And there's going to be a lot of talk about what's going on and why we're so divided. And we know from our reporting that there's a small movement growing, but still relatively small movement within philanthropy and the nonprofit world to try to address those divides, to try to look at polarization. What are the root causes? What can be done? So we felt like this was a good pairing of, one, our interest in expanding the idea of what opinion is, to also look at something that's very topical, and to also provide sort of a space for the nonprofit world to sort of learn about what's happening in this space, learn about the different strategies, approaches, what's working, what's not. Someone has once said to me that you're really creating a space also where the philanthropy world can argue with itself. So we're going to be doing a lot of work to bring together people who may have opposing ideas on strategies, approaches to close divides. We have some essays at our launch that include some that are saying, you know, philanthropy should not be in this space to begin with. Why the heck are they trying to deal with polarization? So the Commons is a name we feel like is representative of our idea of bringing together a lot of perspectives and putting it out there for people to take a look at.
So you sort of touched on something that I was thinking about is, why is this an issue in the philanthropy space? You know, why are these charities and nonprofits concerned about this?
I think what you're hearing from a lot of the funders is that they are having a hard time making progress on the things that they want to move, whether it's advocacy at the political level or even basic services, that sometimes the world is so divided. And you think about polarization, it's reached from Congress now to the daily level, the school board level, to all sort of walks of life. And what some funders are sort of realizing is that they can't get their work done without addressing this at the same time. I'll give you an example. There's a funder that I've been speaking with that is doing a lot of work in this space. They are chiefly an education funder, and they were one of the originators in a lot of the movement for charter schools back in the 90s. And you and I are probably old enough to remember back in the 90s, there was a pretty broad bipartisan consensus around charter schools. There were Democrats and Republicans all on board thinking this is a good idea. What they told me is that, you know, that consensus is completely blown apart, that they can't get the traction and movement that they want on charter schools anymore because of the division. So they're doing work at this point to sort of address the polarization, address division, so they can try to move that issue forward.
So what are you hoping to accomplish with this? You recognizing that there's a problem, you know, what are you going to do and how are you going to do it?
What we're hoping to accomplish, I think organizationally, we do, as I said, we are opening up how we work and do opinion. So that's sort of a good experiment for us, a good way to test some things out. We're doing more multimedia. We're going to be doing some recorded conversations. We've never done video journalism. We're going to be doing some video journalism. So this is a way for us to open up as an organization. As an organization, we want to reach some new readers. We feel like, again, 2024 is going to have everybody in the country focused on divides. And if we have content that gets us into the conversation, we will be introduced to a whole new set of nonprofit leaders. Perhaps, you know, we can jump the fence, and some folks who are worried about these issues at the national level will see us and be introduced to us for the first time. So that's, you know, for an organization, that's what we're hoping to do. For the field itself, again, I was talking to someone the other day who said, you know, we really are in our sophomore year as a movement, and that knowing that, I think we can become almost a place for that movement to coalesce in a sense. And I don't mean this in a way we're advocating for it. But again, if you bring in all these ideas and bring in all these people to talk about what's going on in this space, it can become a hub where they learn about each other, learn about what other folks are doing, learn what works, what doesn't. The three themes that we're sort of driving this on are ideas, conversations, and solutions. And so when we talk about ideas, I'll again go to our kickoff. We've got essays from 12 different people who are in this space and working on these issues, sort of making a pitch for why their approach or what are the issues they're trying to address with the work they're doing. These people range from a Darren Walker, who's the head of the Ford Foundation, which is one of the largest groups in the country, to a fellow named Michael Ware, who leads a Center for Christianity in the Public. So you have field advocates, you have big funders, you have lots of different folks who are going to be in this space putting out their ideas for what has to be done. We're also going to have a theme for around conversations. For the launch, we have an interview with Robert Putnam. So again, if you know, he's the author of Bowling Alone from about 20 years ago. that really was the landmark pioneering research for the disintegration of civic bonds at the local level, this idea of communities falling away and faltering. We have an interview we've done not with a journalist, but with Eric Liu, who is a nonprofit leader. He runs Citizen University out of Seattle, which is one of the leading sort of civic engagement groups. It's great because Eric was a student of Robert's 20 years ago, and part of his syllabus was reading the draft chapters of Bowling Alone. So we put them together basically to talk about how do we get into this mess and how do we get out? And that's one of the things we want to do in this vertical is have more conversations, have more people talking to each other, and oftentimes without journalists in the room. And the last sort of theme is sort of solutions. And I don't mean that in the sense of we're going to have the answers. I think we're going to put forward and highlight things that seem promising, that philanthropy is funding, that there are, you know, different approaches to show the field and show the nation what is happening and what they're doing. We have a piece in the first issue that is looking at efforts that have decided, you know, we're never going to solve polarization at the congressional level. That there are just too many factors there. But at the local level, if we can get people, local community leaders who are doing good civic work and have invested in their community, if we can support them and get them, make them sort of a draw for people, it'll draw people in a city or a town together and work on projects where they're able to put their political identity aside. And so remember, you know, we're part of this town, we're part of this county. The first one we did, it's a woman I love. Her name's L.B. Purvett, and she's in a small town in the North Carolina mountains. She grew up in the town. She's lesbian and was sort of known at that time that she was lesbian. She was harassed, and close to the end of her senior year in high school, she was beaten, left unconscious. She left town like a lot of kids do, leaving small towns. She left town. She went to college. But her dad died, and she came back to town, and she was amazed at all the people that sort of wrapped her up. They came to her farm. They worked her farm for her. They brought her food. They did all these things for her. And she made this very intentional pivot in her life of, I'm going to put aside that fear, the anger that I have from that those days. I'm going to see the good in people. I'm going to see the good in the people of this town. And she has invested herself into the town and the county where she lives in a whole host of ways. And she's now getting some philanthropy funding to sort of spread the seeds, in a sense, fund people who are doing good projects and can bring out others to work on the community. So those are the kind of stories I think that will resonate on a level beyond just our philanthropy crowd.
So what do you see as the benefit for the Chronicle? You're pursuing a different audience. Is there a financial aspect of it? Is it, you know, we're servicing our base, and that means we need to bring our base to a different audience?
It's several things. We, for most of our history, have been part of a for-profit organization. We spun off as a nonprofit almost exactly a year ago. And as we've done that, we've always been a mission-driven organization, but now it makes us think a little deeper about what is our contribution, what is our mission and work in the field. So again, this is fulfilling our role as a nonprofit, I think, to sort of serve as this hub for folks who are interested in this space and want to learn more, to bring our journalism to bear on a topic that has critical importance in 2024. I think as a news organization, we're like every other news outlet in the country. We are looking to expand our audience, deepen our connection with them, deepen our engagement. We think these different formats of opinion, these different formats will help us engage differently. You know, we really feel like that it's a market penetration thing, if you think about it as a business, that we have X number of readers, and there are plenty more out there that perhaps have never even heard of us. So if we can expand our reach and show our value and prove our relevance, that'll help us along the way too.
So what form does this take? I mean, is it going to be a print publication? I know you said that for the first time you're going to do some video, so obviously it's going to be online or broadcast in some way. From a practical sense, how are they going to be consuming your content?
So we are a monthly print magazine, and we're launching. The Commons took over our April issue of the magazine, but we really aim for this to be more digital. And so we've created a separate landing page, almost a microsite for this, for the Commons content. So it will live on its own. We will market and promote it on its own. We'll have a weekly newsletter that will start as part of a Chronicle philanthropy product, but will eventually sort of move off on its own. So if you think about any news outlet that creates a vertical, we're sort of pursuing the same thing. We're giving it its own space. We're giving it a homepage and an identity and entity unto itself. and then we'll use newsletters and other means to get it out to folks.
So is this a one-man band, or do you have a staff that's working on this?
There's no direct staff. We have a newsroom here with the Chronicle that I'm relying on. We're also, you know, as I said, we're doing a lot of opinion, so I'm drawing and having a lot of conversations with folks in the field. We're going to use some freelancers as well. We don't want it as any journalism outfit. I don't want to take away from the core work that we're doing that readers count on for us, but we'll tap our newsroom. There are particular stories that we want to do that sort of look at how philanthropy itself might be contributing to polarization. Some of the biggest foundations in the country are a little bit at a distance from the average people, both in their language, their grant making, how they go about things. So some of our folks in the newsroom will be able to do some of the scrutiny that will apply to philanthropy broadly.
And I see how that services your core audience, especially if this is something that, as they're trying to do their mission, they're dealing with a sort of a different environment. You know, the way things have changed, the growth in polarization. So for you, what would be a successful outcome? What are you hoping to accomplish with this?
A lot of engagement. I would love that if this became a spot where people came to sort of trade ideas and trade perspectives. And, you know, so we are setting up the digital site and the story pages to try to take in opinions, take in perspective. We're going to have polls on pages. We really want to try to make this as dynamic a homepage as possible, or dynamic a space as possible. And that would be the goal for me, is to have a lot of people who really come to rely on this to sort of check what they're doing and check what the field is doing. I think as an organization, our goals obviously is that growth in attracting more readers, attracting more eyes. We feel like we have, our content is relevant and valuable to a ton of folks, but if they've never heard of us, they don't know to rely on us or come to us. So this is another vehicle for us to get out in front of people.
As a journalist who says that he got interested in journalism at the knee of his mother watching the the hearings, the House hearings, I guess it was this congressional hearings around Watergate, you know, what's your perspective on the division in this country? If you're a journalist, you've been paying attention to things for years, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting in that if you look up any of the sort of experts on this, they'll have 14 causes of polarization and sort of tick it through. And, you know, I won't go through all of them, but I think we all sort of immediately devolve to politics. And it is true to some extent in that if you just take, for example, gerrymandering, which sort of creates these congressional districts that are, I will say, filled with the extreme or another extreme. So, you know, districts that are carved out so that they're very Republican or very Democratic. So therefore, the candidates who win primaries there tend to hug to the extremes. So I think, you know, you can look at politics, and when I talk about philanthropy working in this space, there are some philanthropies that are looking at election reforms. If you've heard of ranked choice voting, there are a number of donors who are working in that space trying to expand ranked choice voting and have that work. But I think if you look beyond to causes of polarization beyond politics, Putnam, for example, talks about that the progressive era in the early 1900s of the country was another time of high polarization, high division, high isolation of people. And we had at the same time then high inequality, just like we do now. So inequality being one of those drivers, you've probably heard of the expression the big fort, and that people today sort of tend to live and self-segregate in terms of the neighborhoods they pick, the schools they pick, the colleges, so that we have, in a sense, become more divided just by our choices of where we live and how we go about life. I think the external forces that we all talk about and know, I'll say, and pulling us to the extremes are the outrage industry. So both the cable news outlets, podcasts, social media in particular. There's a great stat that people keep throwing at me as I report on this, that I think it's 80% of the content on Twitter is generated by 10% of the people. And that is pulling us to, those 10% are often the loudest voices. There's a researcher I talked to who said, he's a neuroscientist, and he talked about this, and that there's a trick your brain plays, that your brain assumes the loudest voices repeated the most are the majority. So we all, in a sense, are thinking we're a lot more divided than we actually are. He's got some data showing that there's some real places where we have some commonality in terms of the values and what we want for the country. But we're so influenced by these loud voices that we think, oh, we're really divided. So I guess my main point is that I think, and this is something we're trying to do in our coverage, is to try to make clear to people we're not just talking politics. We're not just talking about the divisions in Congress. It's divisions across the board and the polarization that sort of across the country.
Just sort of go back to the example that I gave before about homelessness. One of the communities that I was covering, you know, they had a local charity that runs a day shelter that they wanted to expand. And, you know, they had some funding that would allow them to do that, but it was going to require the approval of the local government. And local government was behind it, but a lot of the citizens weren't. They had very sort of polarizing perceptions about what that shelter was doing. And they saw it less as something good and more of this is the cause of all these problems. And what the city government did, you know, this issue worked its way through and they passed the approval so that this project could go forward. But the next step they took was, okay, we're going to look at this. You know, they opened it up to all the people to come in, and there are presentations by the different departments in the government, but then also some of the charities. And the idea is you just have this sort of super dialogue. Here are the facts. This is why this is happening. It's not because of, you know, this one entity. It's about a larger problem that involves the county and the state and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And so that's the situation where people had to come in and be willing to, you know, open themselves up. And some of the people came in with the idea that they were going to express their, you know, negative, you know, this is what I believe, this is what's going on, this needs to be fixed. But eventually you began to see people understanding that homeless people, even though they're homeless, are actually residents of where you live. And they're part of your community. And you can't just like, well, let's just march them to the end, you know, the edge of the city boundary or throw them in jail. It says, well, you can't do that. I can't come into your house and arrest you. So it's this idea of creating the space, which is what you're trying to do, and getting people to talk and listen. I guess listen's the important thing.
I'm curious, did that forum allow for a good debate and a healthy debate? Did it dissolve into fighting and yelling, or what was it like?
Well, it was interesting how they did it. They had a facilitator at the beginning. They had like several public meetings, and they just, you know, what does homelessness mean to you? And then people in the audience says, you know, this and this. And so it was just like big sheets of paper with the things that they objected to or their thoughts on it, problems, how they could address those problems. And they used that to sort of inform a task force. And it was at that point where, you know, people looked at these things, that these opinions that people had expressed, and they sort of began grouping them together, and they tried to examine what the causes were, and, you know, maybe there are ways to address this. But eventually they, you know, everybody who was participating in the process all kind of came to the same, I don't want to say conclusion, but the same understanding of the problem. And once you get to that point, you can start, you know, trying to make changes.
Well, that's critical, the same understanding of the problem, because I think we also, when we talk about misinformation, disinformation, oftentimes the basic facts of what is it at issue aren't agreed upon. So, and the fact that these folks were in a room together, it's often stressed to me that toxic polarization is a term beyond polarization, in the sense where you dehumanize the other side and you see them as evil and not having good intent. And a lot of the efforts that I've heard and are writing about, it's trying to get people in the same room so they could recognize the humanity of the other side and hear their argument and realize that this is not, you know, there are legitimate concerns perhaps driving a lot of this. So I think that's critical.
This sounds like a really kind of wonderful thing that you're doing. Do you have measures in place? Are there things you're going to be looking at to see, you know, engagement and, you know, involvement and, you know, growth in the conversation?
Right. Well, as a nonprofit, we're always trying to look at measures of impact, and every nonprofit will tell you that's not as always easy as metrics itself. But I will say we have sort of created some very conservative metrics about what we expect in terms of page views and engagement and such. I would think we would do much better than those, but again, this is something we've never done, so we're very cautious about what to expect. We feel like this will iterate over time, and that we have launched in April, and I would expect what you would see in December would be very different. That's sort of exciting. And as somebody who comes from the print magazine world, to sort of evolve as we go is also a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I congratulate you on that. Not everybody makes that decision, that transition so easily. Not that maybe it was very difficult. I don't know. But Anyway, so where can people go to, you know, find all this great content that the Commons is going to be doing?
It's going to have, again, it's going to have its own space, its own homepage. So go to philanthropy.com/the Commons and you'll get right there. So philanthropy.com/the Commons.
This seems like a great thing. You know, people should go check out your website and see the type of content that you're doing. And I'll try to check back in with you, you know, come December. So congratulations on starting this initiative. And I hope that your numbers go off over the roof and you begin to see engagement and conversations around issues to try to end some of this polarization.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. We're excited and I appreciate the time to come on and talk about it.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the people who report the news. You can find out more about us and download past episodes at itsalljournalism.com. While you're visiting our website, sign up for the It's All Journalism newsletter. To make sure you don't miss an episode of It's All Journalism, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, Google Play, Amazon, and pretty much anywhere good podcasts are found. If you'd like to help us grow our podcast, like and share our episodes on social media. Look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. It takes a lot of people to create an episode of It's All Journalism. Nicola Grisco is our audio producer. Amber Healy writes our web content. Amelia Brust is our booking manager. Steph Thomas manages our social media. Nick Dupre composed our theme music. Carolyn Bilewski designed our logo. And I'm your host, Michael O'Connell. Thanks for listening.